people have come here to be healed, not to be harassed, not to be intimidated, not to be protested against. And so this is a false protest on these grounds.
The demonstration and the denunciation. Anti-vaccine protesters pick a hospital as the site of a rally against pandemic measures and mandates. The congregation met with condemnation for their choice of venue. Good evening. This was one of several events planned across the country today.
Under the close watch of police, the group warned not to obstruct the life-saving work happening inside. CTV Sean Leithong is live outside Toronto General Hospital tonight with more. Sean.
Well, Michelle and Nathan, this protest was condemned by public officials and healthcare workers. But even though that happened, they came here early this afternoon and they protested against decisions that were made somewhere else.
With those caring for the sick looking on, a protest in front of Toronto General Hospital brought a conflicting message.
I want to support the idea of freedom.
On the sidewalk out front, a group of protesters stood with messages against vaccines, against vaccine mandates, and against passports. But it is not the right to protest that was up for debate, but rather the choice to do so in front of a hospital. Dr. Raghu Vengopal is an emergency room physician, and he says this needs to be done elsewhere.
Behind us is sacred ground. This is a place where people come to get healed.
Patients like 87-year-old Alba, who needed a police escort, and her daughter Arida to help her wade through the crowd.
The doctors are tired. The nurses are tired. Everybody's tired of taking care of people.
Or Gemma DeGasperis, who came here for her father's cancer treatment.
Definitely not, you know? Definitely go to Queen's Park.
But for about 90 minutes this afternoon, the crowd remained.
I've been fired from both my jobs already for speaking out. My license is under investigation. We were defamed on national TV January.
Organizer Sarah Kajunian is a nurse who we first covered back in January after taking part in an event with a group called Nurses Against Lockdowns in Washington, D.C. on January 6th, the same day as the Capitol riot. Today, she says the choice to protest at the hospital was about being heard.
We're also here and chose the hospitals because we want to show support to the nurses inside who are being coerced to take the jab or lose their jobs and who are being censored.
But many seem to direct their attention to the media.
You guys are traitors, in fact, to your own people. Traitors.
Traitors.
You want everyone to hate us? Division. Divide and conquer. That's what it's about. Division. Let's stop the division.
Leaving others like Dan, whose wife is a healthcare worker and battled COVID in the first wave, frustrated with what he is seeing.
They're so caught up in this argument about rights that they've forgot about their responsibilities.
Now, you saw in the story there was a heavy police presence during the protest. We found out from Toronto Police that no hospital services along the row were disrupted during this protest. Reporting live, I'm Sean Leithong. Michelle, send it back to you.
Thank you, Sean. Ontario students are freshly back to class, but already it's clear COVID-19 will be at the top of the lesson plan this year.
Dozens of cases of the virus being reported in schools across the GTA. CTV's Janice Golding is live with more. Janice.
Nathan, nearly all of the GTHA's school boards are reporting at least one case of COVID-19, and as you noted, school only resumed last week.
A whole classroom of St. Michel French Catholic Elementary School students is in isolation today, along with several employees after a staff member there tested positive for COVID-19.
Made my heart sink.
As a parent, of course, I'm concerned about it.
More details in terms of which grade would have been great.
Cases have been confirmed in at least three Toronto schools, St. Michel Elementary, West Hill Collegiate, and Fraser Mustard Early Learning Center.
You know, it's unfortunate, but it's not unexpected. When you have more than 200,000 students returning to school, plus all of the staff.
In all, at school boards in the Greater Toronto and Hamilton area, there are more than 70 active cases of COVID-19, with nearly every board reporting at least one case.
Leaders in pediatrics across the GTA are preparing. You know, we are preparing for potential surges, and hopefully we don't need to use that. I think, you know, the key is to try and be prepared as opposed to panic.
Given children under the age of 12 cannot be vaccinated, doctors CTV spoke with say they are at higher risk of contracting the highly transmissible Delta variant.
I think that there is a reasonable amount of concern given what is happening in the environment right now of COVID-19. It's why we're calling and have called for vaccine requirements for teachers and others who work in schools. We want to try and create this firewall around these schools so that kids can be safe
Parents say they think new cases are inevitable, but they're trusting that others are following the recommended protocols, like masking and physical distancing, to keep our children safe.
All we can do is teach our kids the proper techniques to stay, help themselves stay protected. Wear your mask, stop touching your face, proper hand hygiene.
I think our school is doing the best it can under the circumstances.
The school itself has all of their protocols in place, so I have confidence in that.
And even with the omnipresent risk of COVID-19, Dr. Kassam says there is no substitute for in-class learning and interaction for children's physical, mental, and psychological well-being.
Now, the Toronto District School Board says it is working closely with Toronto Public Health. In the meantime, if you want up-to-date information about active cases in your school board, you should head to your board's website because they are publishing up-to-date information daily. Reporting live, I'm Janice Golding. Now back to Michelle.
Thank you, Janice. Turning to the newest COVID-19 case count across the province, Public Health Ontario is logging 600 new cases in its most recent update. 475 of those cases are among people who either aren't fully vaccinated or their vaccination status is unknown. More than 19,000 tests have been processed in the last 24 hours, and the province's positivity rate is sitting at 3.1%.
627 more cases are now considered resolved, raising that total to more than 559,000 over the course of the pandemic. Six more deaths are linked to the virus, although the province notes two of those deaths occurred more than 2 months ago. 9,617 lives have been lost to COVID-19 in Ontario.
Here's a look at tonight's regional breakdown with 114 new cases in the city of Toronto, 84 in Peel Region. York has 67 new cases with 32 in Hamilton. There are 28 new cases in both Halton and Niagara, and Durham logged 20 cases.
Meanwhile, COVID restrictions are starting at many workplaces.
The clock counting down for workers to provide proof of protection, but what exactly happens after that? CTV's Mike Walker reports.
The vaccination deadline quickly approaching for City of Toronto employees who now have until September 17th to disclose whether they're fully immunized.
The deadline was today, but we know we have a number of employees who, you know, are not connected to work email, for example, so, you know, work in the field.
Since announcing its vaccine mandate last month, the city reporting more than half of its 37,000 employees have disclosed their vaccination status.
That 97% are either fully or partially vaccinated, 93% fully vaccinated, so that's a very good thing.
Staff who are not fully immunized or do not disclose their status by Friday will have to attend an education session on vaccines and are required to provide proof of their first dose by September 30th and proof of their second dose by October 30th.
I think that's kind of necessary. It's kind of protect for everybody.
A similar vaccine mandate also taking effect today for TTC employees, but some workers argue the policy is an overreach.
It's a privacy thing. I think you should be able to tell them on your own, and they shouldn't demand it at all. But I can see their point of view too, where they want everybody protected in the workplace.
The TTC says it's working closely with its five unions to encourage compliance.
We're moving hundreds of thousands of people. It's in their best interest to be vaccinated. It's in our customers' best interest for them to be vaccinated as well. So for right now, we're focused solely on the education piece.
There are medical and human rights exemptions, but employees who do not comply could be disciplined or lose their job.
We don't want to go there, though. We will deal with those on a case-by-case basis.
There's a number of employees that are quite anxiety-ridden.
This labor lawyer says her firm has seen a 100% increase in calls from people now concerned about their employment status.
Across both the public and private sector is that these policies are being put in place to keep employees safe. And so that generally would trump an employee's right to make decisions around their own health.
The union representing the city's 20,000 indoor workers saying in a statement, Local 79 encourages everyone to get vaccinated, but understands that some of our members have legitimate human rights grounds for not getting the vaccine. We expect the city to review requests for accommodation on a case-by-case basis, as they have promised, and we will work to represent our members through that process. The city says it's committed to working with its employees who are not yet fully vaccinated, but is remaining firm on its policy. Mike Walker, CTV News.
Across the province, more than 84.3% of eligible people have now received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine. That represents just over 11 million people. And more than 78% of eligible people are now double-dosed, representing nearly 10.2 million people.
Meanwhile, thousands of baseball fans need to bring more than their tickets to Rogers Center tonight.
This marks the first game when people entering the ballpark also need to provide proof of vaccination. CTV's Saran Fennell is live with more. Saran.
That's right. We're about an hour away from game time and fans are starting to trickle in. If you do show up to a game starting tonight, you will have to be either fully vaccinated or show proof of a negative COVID-19 test. And that is the first thing you're going to be asked before you can even go through security and the screening process. Gates open at 5:30 on game nights and they're saying come early.
Major leagues.
The Toronto Blue Jays are coming off a record-breaking weekend, scoring 44 runs in the last three games.
Home run!
The red-hot team is now in wild-card position, and tickets are going fast. Fans from around the country booking last-minute flights into the city to take in the action.
We're from Saskatchewan, and we're in crowds at the Rider games.
We
try to be safe.
Yeah.
Well, I see that it's for Ontario. Doesn't have the same as BC, but I'm sure we'll be fine. I got my photos of my tickets and vaccines.
Starting today, all fans and staff 12 years old and up will have to show proof they're fully vaccinated or provide a negative COVID-19 test taken within 48 hours of the game's scheduled time. The team is accepting any two doses approved for use in Canada. They must be received at least 14 days before the day of the game.
I guess if that's what it takes to get to the Jays game, I'm there, you know, no problem at all. It's not ideal, but it's the best thing we can do for this time.
If it's something that we need in order to enjoy something that we like doing, then by all means, and if it keeps everyone safe, then yeah, it's worth it.
Proof of full vaccination includes either documentation issued by the public health authority that administered the vaccine, such as an Ontario Ministry of Health COVID-19 vaccination receipt, a government-issued vaccination record or receipt from another Canadian province or territory, or a vaccination card issued by the CDC. This can be displayed on your phone or printed. You'll also need a piece of government ID. If you don't meet these requirements, you'll be denied entry.
I guess it is what it is. I don't know if I 100% agree with mandates, but...
For the Jansons, whose daughter works as a registered nurse, the virus is nothing to take lightly.
It's not a fake thing. It's a real thing. My daughter-in-law has told me many times how many times she's held the hand of a patient who's died because they couldn't have a family member there.
The Toronto Blue Jays are back at home, opening up the series against the Tampa Bay Rays. The Jays say if you do decide to show a negative COVID-19 test, the ones done at home that are self-administered will not be accepted. And just a reminder for fans who are coming to the game, there is no testing site here at the Rogers Centre for fans. Reporting live, I'm Saran Fennell. Nathan, over to you.
All right, thank you, Saran. And our online team is staying on top of all the rules beginning to take effect across the GTA. You can find those details at ctvnewstoronto.ca.
After a lovely day, clouds have pushed in and there is the potential for some wet weather, even a thunderstorm. Michelle Jobin is here. What are you seeing? Are we going to get some wet weather?
Well, we do have the risk of seeing some showers this evening through the GTA. And behind me here, you can see some active weather that has certainly rolled through southwestern Ontario and the Niagara region. Saw some pictures of Fort Erie earlier. Very, very dark skies. And, of course, heavier rainfall with this. There were severe thunderstorm watches and warnings that have now been dropped. But there's more activity headed for the London area as we speak. In terms of what we're seeing, light winds are relatively light in the GTA right now. We're looking at that widespread potential for showers and storms tonight, but even more so tomorrow. Temperatures have been comfortable today. They remain so heading into the overnight. We got to a high of 24 today at Pearson. We're at 21 right now, 20 at the islands, heading to an overnight low of 14. Tomorrow, hot and humid, feeling into the mid-30s, widespread risk of severe thunderstorms. So we have lots to talk about coming up. Michelle?
Thank you. Next to a developing story at Western University, where four formal complaints of sexual assault have been filed. The alleged incidents believed to have taken place during orientation week.
Reports of dozens of women being drugged and assaulted are still being investigated, while students and faculty say the school is failing to create a safe environment. CTV's Raheem Ladani joins us in studio with the latest on this story. Raheem.
Well, Nathan and Michelle, the first allegations came to light with students posting to social media alleging female students from a dorm had been sexually assaulted. Now, the university says it's still trying to clarify those reports, but now a different set of sexual assault allegations have resulted in arrests.
Medway Sydenham Hall is the residence where up to 30 women were allegedly drugged and sexually assaulted during orientation week at Western University.
I've heard of multiple girls, way more than there ever should have been, getting possibly roofied. And one case of sexual assault, I'm sure there are many more that I've unraveled over the past little bit. It's very disturbing that this is my first year here. It hasn't even been a week. And this is already happening.
London police haven't received any formal complaints, but in a statement say, given the seriousness of the allegations raised in relation to incidents occurring at Medway Sydenham Hall, the London Police Service has opened an investigation. The university says the reports have not been confirmed.
We have been asking and following up with, sort of individuals that have come forward. But at this point, we have received very little information related to what we're seeing online.
Meanwhile, the university is investigating four other sexual violence allegations which are not related.
Western has facilitated arrest and removing students from residents while investigations continue.
But some students don't believe the university is doing enough for potential victims.
First, we'll say we don't have enough women coming forward. And then when they're coming forward, you're saying it doesn't happen. You're going to have future women don't want to come out because of things like this.
While some faculty believe the university is fueling a toxic environment.
They're having giant parties. When you mix together that kind of energy with alcohol, drugs, unfortunately, the reality is bad things may happen. Western didn't cause gender-based violence to occur, by no means, but we created the conditions by bringing students back and I think lulling them into a sense of false security.
A secure and safe environment students expected returning to campus.
Now, details of the four formal sexual violence claims haven't been made available. While the university says it has increased security in residence and has on-site confidential counseling for students. Reporting live, I'm Raheem Ladani. Nathan, back to you.
All right, thank you, Raheem. He's being remembered as a light of the neighborhood and a pillar of the community.
A shooting victim being honored by loved ones and friends as police search for his killer. CTV's Beth McDonnell reports.
A leader in the Jane and Finch community, Kwajo Asamoah Boachi, is going to be greatly missed. Friends and family call him Sam. He grew up in the neighborhood and was very involved in making a positive difference.
It's very challenging. We're having a hard time with Sam's loss. We're having a hard time with the families that we're working with.
Muhammad Ahmed has known Asamoah Boachi for about a decade. On top of being a dad, his friend and colleague ran programs helping young people.
Sam was hilarious. He was an amazing person to be around. He was able to, I feel, connect with the ambitions that we have within ourselves and bring that to life.
Toronto police say the 30-year-old was shot multiple times and died of his injuries. It happened last Tuesday night, shortly before 9, near Driftwood Avenue and Grand Ravine Drive. Two cousins tell CTV News Asamoah Boachi was visiting family that night, gunned down as he was leaving.
Police say no arrests have been made. Investigators are speaking with witnesses and reviewing video. They haven't ruled out the possibility Asamoah Boachi was in the wrong place at the wrong time.
It's a shock because, you know, that's the only thing I could see. It's because, you know, he was a unifying dude.
Amin Binwali also knew Asamoah Boachi for the past decade. Asamoah Boachi co-founded Out of the Box, a social enterprise and construction organization. Binwali says bringing people together in Toronto was one of his passions.
Everybody knew him, you know, from the community workers to the business people to, you know, the people in the community. Everybody knew him and he got along with everybody.
A GoFundMe page asks for prayers and donations, saying the magnitude of this tragedy is inconceivable. Binwali says coming together and sharing Asamoah Boachi's light is a way to honor his life. Beth McDonnell, CTV News.
Still ahead, the new CTV News podcast revisiting some of Toronto's most memorable and notorious stories of true crime and hearing from the person at the center of those investigations.
The federal election is 1 week tonight, and the gloves are coming off.
As the leaders begin the final stretch, the tone on the campaign trail is getting personal. CTV's Heather Butts reports.
Conservative leader Aaron O'Toole is touting his plan to support parents.
Making sure that when parents have children, they get the time they need to adjust to parenthood.
The conservatives are pledging to allow new parents to earn and keep up to $1,000 per month without impacting their maternity or parental leave, provide the Canada Child Benefit in the seventh month of pregnancy to help purchase essentials, and create a national adoption strategy, including expanded EI and increasing the adoption expense tax credit from $15,000 to $20,000. But the policy promise wasn't O'Toole's primary focus, spending part of his time at the podium leveling personal attacks against his main opponent.
When Mr. Trudeau was partying, and we've all seen the photos, I was doing search and rescue missions in the military. Every Canadian has met a Justin Trudeau in their lives. Privileged, entitled, and always looking out for number one.
Trudeau is vowing to stay above the fray.
I'm going to let him and his proxies in the anti-vaxxer movement, in the gun lobby, in the anti-choice crowd, continue to attack me? Fine. I'm going to continue to stay focused on Canadians.
With protests against pandemic-related restrictions taking place at hospitals nationwide today, the Liberal leader is promising to pass legislation to make it a criminal offense to block access to buildings that provide health care and make it a criminal offense to intimidate or threaten any health care professional carrying out their duties.
It's not right that the people tasked with keeping us safe and alive during this pandemic should be exposed to hatred, violence, fear, and intimidation.
The NDP leader is in Northern Ontario promising $2.9 billion to end boil water advisories in Indigenous communities, flying to the Neshkandaga First Nation.
It's a community that's gone through the longest period of time with not having access to clean drinking water, but it represents a problem that is across the country, particularly in Northern Ontario. And for me, it's something that we want to fix.
Today marked the final day of advance polls. Elections Canada says more than 1.3 million people voted on Friday. Tuesday evening is the deadline to apply for mail-in ballots. Heather Butts, CTV News, Toronto.
And all this week, we're going to be taking a deeper look at some of the issues facing people here in the GTA, the things that could sway voters as they make up their minds.
Tonight, the path out of the pandemic and what the main parties are promising. CTV's Natalie Johnson reports.
33-year-old Ryan Thornton chose to get his second COVID-19 vaccine today in order to attend his kids' sports games.
I'm just doing it so I can try to continue a normal life.
But doesn't think anyone should be forced to get the shot to keep their job.
There's a lot of people who are going to lose their jobs if they're not vaccinated. How do you support a family?
Whereas Lane Curry travels for work and doesn't mind having to get the shot to maintain her career.
It's a privilege to travel, so I think everyone should be vaccinated.
The path out of the pandemic is high on the list of party pitches during this federal campaign. A big ballot box issue for anyone who travels, is a federally regulated worker, or just wants a return to pre-pandemic life.
That would start and finish with those in political power.
Canadians need to keep getting vaccinated. We're leading the world on vaccinations, but we need to keep it up.
Justin Trudeau's Liberals support mandatory COVID-19 vaccines for travelers on planes, trains, and cruise ships, and for federal public servants, and would provide $1 billion to support provincial vaccine certificates for use in non-essential businesses and public spaces. The Liberals would also table legislation that protects businesses and organizations that require vaccination from lawsuits, would invest $100 million to study the long-term health impacts of COVID-19, and would spend $9 billion to train and better pay thousands of new PSWs.
We want to make it easier to get vaccinated by providing more awareness and promoting folks to get vaccinated.
The NDP would support mandatory vaccines for federal workers and discipline, including termination, for those who refuse, and would also back an international travel-focused vaccine passport that could be used domestically. The NDP would also expand domestic manufacturing capacity for vaccines and PPE, would establish a Crown Corporation in charge of vaccine production, and would support the lifting of COVID-19 vaccine patents. The Conservatives, though, say a vaccine requirement for federal workers and travelers goes too far and are instead planning to implement a rapid COVID-19 testing option for anyone who chooses to not get immunized.
It's about having an approach of respect and trying to work with people to overcome any concerns about vaccination.
The conservatives would also require rapid testing at all border entry points and close the border to travelers from hotspots where new variants are detected. The party would also accelerate Health Canada approvals for rapid tests and make at-home rapid tests readily available to Canadians, would implement a national rapid screening program for businesses and public institutions, would ramp up Canadian vaccine research and production, and would increase domestic production of critical supplies and PPE. Also vowing to implement an emergency preparedness plan to prevent future pandemics.
We should never turn a public health issue into a political football.
The Green Party would require COVID-19 vaccines for federally regulated workers, would implement a Canada-wide vaccine passport system, and would build a publicly owned vaccine production facility in Canada. Proposed plans to put an end to COVID-19.
Well, it should be talked about. Do we want the whole entire population in lockdown? No, we don't.
And move Canada past the pandemic. Natalie Johnson, CTV News.
And tomorrow, tackling housing affordability. The GTA is vote rich, but house poor. And the federal parties know that as they battle for every vote. The pitches to those struggling to stay afloat in this red hot real estate market.
And you can follow every moment of this campaign as we draw closer to Election Day on September 20th. Visit election.ctvnews.ca for complete coverage and exclusive polling research. A warning about some of the details in our next story. They are among the crimes this city will never forget. A new series allowing you to hear from one of the people at the center of solving some of Toronto's most notable cases.
Tonight in episode one of The Detective, the killing of Melanie Bittersingh, the teenager's remains found in a suitcase, her father ultimately convicted of her murder. CTV's Austin Delaney is live outside police headquarters tonight. And Austin, this is a podcast, TV, and web series.
And if you like true crime, this is the real thing. My partner in this podcast is CP24's crime analyst, Steve Ryan. Now, he's a former homicide detective right here in Toronto. He helped solve some of the biggest cases. We go back to the scene of the crime. He talks about it very candidly. He peels back the curtain, lets us know what it's like to be a homicide detective as they learn some horrific details, the emotional toil it has on him. And this case that released today, this podcast about Melanie Bittersingh, the suitcase girl, had a profound effect on him, so much so he decided he would leave the homicide squad and leave policing. It's about a 17-year-old girl who was found stuffed in a suitcase weighing just 50 pounds. Beaten and burned. Her body was set on fire. It's the case that the police officer says has bothered him forever because he feels there's something else to it. See, Melanie's younger brother also died under suspicious circumstances. He fell 22 floors. It was ruled a suicide. Steve Ryan doesn't believe it. He just can't prove it.
That noise, that squeak, is what I heard the first time I stepped in here. And that was after the search warrant was being executed in the apartment where they lived.
Former homicide detective and now CP24 crime analyst Steve Ryan is going back to the Parkdale apartment building where he solved the most horrific murder of his career. It was known for years as the suitcase murder because Melanie Bittersingh's remains were found in a suitcase set ablaze in 1994. The 17-year-old had come from Jamaica for a so-called better life here in Canada with her father.
When she came here for the first time, she thought she was going to school. She wanted to be a nurse. She was very excited about meeting new friends. And I don't think she left this place more than five times in 3 years. She was confined to that apartment for basically from the time she walked in here when she first arrived until they took her out in the suitcase.
Instead, she would be beaten by her father, Everton Bittersingh, and her stepmother, Elaine. Ryan rides the elevator to her 22nd floor apartment saying Melanie had no idea that first day in Canada that the trap was set.
I see this as a spider web and it actually makes me feel kind of, I don't want to say anxious, but it makes me feel for her, for what she was thinking when she was in this going up for the first time, how happy she was. And then the last time she's going down in a suitcase and that was the end of her. So I mean, it's heartbreaking.
It really is.
Yeah, it is.
You know, so we know the answer. But she didn't.
That's right. Yeah, she didn't. Just a kid.
Along with her younger brother, Dwayne, half-brother Cleon, she led a life of horror, beaten, chained to a chair, starved, and forced to stand in a tiny dark closet for hours at a time. The thought of her in the closet haunts Ryan to this day.
In one of the closets, there was scratch marks on the wall. And I imagined her doing this with her nails, trying to go through the drywall to get back out here into the hallway. And I thought, and I still think this, that as a kid, who was she calling out for? Mom and dad are the ones that you call out for when you're sick, when you're hurt, when you're scared. Well, she was all three. And mom and dad are the ones that put her in that closet. So who was she calling out for help?
When she was found in the suitcase, the 17-year-old weighed just 50 pounds. But it would be years before those remains were identified as Melanie's. It was Elaine Bittersingh who told police her husband killed Melanie. He would be found guilty of first-degree murder, she of second-degree. But the former homicide detective needed to find out if younger brother Dwayne suffered the same fate. He died after falling from the 22nd-floor balcony. The death ruled suicide. The night before the 14-year-old's remains would be exhumed, Ryan dropped by the gravesite.
I stood by Dwayne's gravesite, and then I told him that I actually apologized to him and said that we're going to be disturbing him tomorrow because I wanted to make sure that nobody did this to him. Nobody hurt him or killed him.
All they found were bones. Impossible to tell if he had been murdered. But to this day, Ryan doesn't believe Dwayne took his own life. Rather, he believes he fell off the balcony trying to escape a beating by his father.
Hey!
Raquel, how are you?
I'm fine.
Good.
How are you doing?
Look at your big smile.
Oh, you're looking good.
This is Melanie's sister, Raquel. Ryan keeps in close contact with her and her mother. She tells him today the family is no closer to closure. They just want to know why.
And we revisit a lot of other cases, including Stephanie Rangel, the 14-year-old girl who was killed by a jealous girl who thought her boyfriend was sleeping with him. Also, the case of Cecilia Zhang, the 19-year-old girl who was kidnapped and murdered because a Chinese national wanted to have some money so he could buy a marriage convenience. Holly Jones, she's the 10-year-old girl who police say, Steve Ryan says, her killer was watching the police officers outside his house as he waited for a garbage truck to come by and pick up her remains. And next week, we'll visit the Frick Shamji murder. She was also found in a suitcase. I hope you'll tune in.
All right. Thank you, Austin. And you can subscribe to The Detective podcast on iHeart or wherever you listen to podcasts. New episodes are released every Monday, and you can read a detailed article on each case on our website, ctvnewstoronto.ca.
Still ahead, expanding the life-saving impact of first aid. The new tools being added to the training, addressing a growing crisis in communities across our country.
Severe weather expected here tomorrow, but right now we're turning our attention to Tropical Storm Nicholas, which is causing lots of problems for parts of Texas, the Central Coast, and also southwestern Louisiana. There are tropical storm warnings, hurricane warnings, because winds could upgrade later this evening, and there's concerns for over 400 millimeters of rain and also storm surges in excess of 1 meter. So this is still a very potent storm, even though it's not at a hurricane status at this time. It will eventually downgrade, but it is packing a lot of moisture with it, so we'll continue to track this situation. And coming up, I'm going to take a look and show you where the broader thunderstorm risk is in your community coming up. We're expecting the possibility of severe storms tomorrow afternoon and evening. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
The Canadian Red Cross is known for swimming and safety programs.
But it's now adding opioid harm reduction to its first aid training amid a rise in overdose deaths. Our health reporter Pauline Chan has the details.
The Red Cross has run CPR and first aid courses for decades.
No, we've always had conversations and learning activities around some different poisonings, those more traditional ones or historical types of poisonings. And This one is new to us.
Now education about opioid harm reduction has been added.
Well, we know in the last 4 to 5 years, this crisis has taken over 20,000 lives across the country. And these are really preventable.
The first aid program can run from 4 to 8 hours, of which opioid safety is just under an hour.
When too many of them bind in, that is what causes the opioid poisoning.
The course includes what are opioids, how to recognize a potential overdose, and treatments, including the use of naloxone.
One of the focuses of the project, actually, is to start increasing the awareness, helping to normalize the conversation, to help train people on how to use it. It's a really safe drug, and it can completely reverse the effects of an opioid poisoning.
And while the course is available for all Canadians, they found the greatest need is in small communities.
The smaller communities, 50,000 people to 100,000, give or take a little bit, are experiencing poisonings twice that of larger cities, greater than 500,000. So we're trying to understand that a little bit better. What are those barriers?
Less emergency services may be one part of it, but a key factor seems to be stigma. And in smaller towns where there may be only one pharmacy, getting an naloxone kit may raise more eyebrows than in a large city. You can get more information on first aid training through redcross.ca. Pauline Chan, CTV News.
To the forecast, the sun is setting a little bit earlier, but it's still lovely to see.
It looks really beautiful. And Michelle, I think tomorrow people might be surprised about how warm it is.
Absolutely. We are looking at summer-like warmth and humidity as we get into tomorrow, Michelle. So we are going to see, we saw a great sunshine today. We will see some more tomorrow. But when we have all these ingredients, heat, humidity, and an approaching cold front, it is the recipe for some volatile weather. So we're going to talk about that. And weather is brought to you by Trane for home comfort, cooling, and clean air. It's hard to stop a train. So lots to talk about in your forecast. Let's take a look at what we're at in terms of current temperatures. 21 degrees in the city of Toronto. We hit a high of 24 today, so a little bit above seasonal. Very pleasant, very comfortable. Minimal humidity today. A little bit more so if you're in the Niagara region. And something I might want to point out to you in the Niagara region is your overnight low. Niagara Falls hitting 21 as your overnight low tonight. Just look, if you just go north across Lake Ontario, Peterborough there, at 7 degrees. So a lot of heat and humidity starting to concentrate, especially in the southern portion of the region. 14 overnight in Toronto. And as we get into tomorrow, here we go. Here's the feeling like summertime, although it is still officially summertime. 27 degrees, feeling like 34 in Toronto, 28, feeling like 36 in Niagara Falls and in Hamilton and in Waterloo, 27, feeling like 35. So widespread thunderstorm risk tomorrow. Areas in orange are of most concern, but even here in the city of Toronto, much of the GTA in moderate risk. We have had some severe weather roll through the region earlier, down through southwestern Ontario in the Niagara region. That has passed through. There is the potential for more. Watch out for showers tonight, then starting the day with some sunshine tomorrow, a mix of sun and cloud. This frontal system increases humidity and then the front approaches. And I'm just going to show you how that plays out in terms of our forecast radar as we get into tomorrow. Not too bad during the day, but watch as we get into the evening and the afternoon and this front slices through. We could see some very active weather in the afternoon tomorrow. And again, watch out for that high, of course, because it's going to be quite warm tomorrow. Stay tuned for a little bit more information on this and take the warnings and watches seriously when they do pop up. Stay with us. We have much more coming up right after the break.
A harrowing real-life story is getting the big screen treatment at TIFF.
A concentration camp survivor's story is the subject of a world premiere tonight, and our Andrea Case joins us now with more. Andrea.
Michelle and Nathan, good evening. You may not have heard of Harry Half, but his story is one that once you do, it's hard to forget. His family joined the stars of the film The Survivor to make sure his story will live on.
I don't see Mr. you looking Hatt, at anything other than right here, this over and it. Over. You
I'm looking where...
I said look again!
No. Oscar-winning director Barry Levinson says The Survivor is a tale of post-traumatic stress, although at the time, there wasn't a name for it. In 1944, Harry Haft was a Jewish prisoner of war who was forced to fight other concentration camp prisoners in order to survive. The loser was sent to the gas chamber. Haft fought and won 76 bouts, eventually moving to America and continued his boxing career. Ben Foster portrays Harry Haft. Foster stresses the story of Holocaust survivors and the immigrant story continues to be important.
And getting to explore this material, which is being erased from, at least in North America, our school curriculum, and with fascist regimes popping up all over the world, it felt like a timely story to get lost in. And that was my goal, is just get lost in it.
Foster and Levinson were reunited on this film. The actor got his first movie role thanks to Levinson in 1999. He was 17.
We're excited in a sense because we finished the film 2 years ago. And so it's literally like been sitting on a shelf for 2 years so that we can show it to an audience. So this is great. This is the very first time that we've ever shown the film to an audience. And so on one hand, it's great to be here. On the other hand, it's like your heart going.
Helen Staccato and Alan Scott Haft are Harry Haft's children.
Even 60 years later, when he was inducted into the National Jewish Sports Hall of Fame, a journalist asked him at the end of his interview, the last question was whether he had any regrets. And he stuck out his hands and he said, "My regrets are the lives that passed through my hands." So it affected him all his life.
Alan Scott Haft wrote the book, which became the basis of the film. He says his father never forgot his traumatic experience, and it was very important that he tell his story. Harry Haft died in 2007.
Ben Foster lost and regained 50 pounds to play the role of a concentration camp survivor. To be stripped of your dignity for him as an actor and still being able to fight gave him energy for the rest of the film. He says it was a privilege and a luxury to do so. Reporting live, I'm Andrea Case.
Stars Tonight is brought to you by Last Men's Bad Boy. Who's better? Nobody.
This is sacred ground. This is a place where people come to get healed.
Updating our top stories, anti-vaccine protesters rallied outside Toronto General Hospital today, despite many saying such a location is not appropriate. At least one patient needed a police escort to get through the crowd. There were similar protests across the country.
Made my heart sink.
As a parent, of course, I'm concerned about it.
More details in terms of which grade would have been great.
COVID-19 cases have been confirmed in at least three Toronto schools. They are St. Michel Elementary, West Hill Collegiate, and Fraser Mustard Early Learning Centre. There are more than 70 active cases at school boards in the GTA and Hamilton area.
If it's something that we need in order to enjoy something that we like doing, then by all means, and if it keeps everyone safe, then yeah, it's worth it.
Starting tonight, all Jays staff and fans 12 and up will have to show proof they've been fully vaccinated or will have to provide a negative COVID-19 test. If not, you won't get into the ballpark.
Today's protest outside Toronto General Hospital is drawing plenty of reaction.
And that's the focus of a discussion on CP24 tonight. We're joined by Reshmi Nair and Jackie Crandles. Reshmi, you'll be speaking with healthcare leaders and frontline workers about how the events unfolded today.
Yes, Nathan, there was a lot of talk leading up to today's protest. So how were these people feeling leading up to it? How did it all unfold for them? And what is their takeaways? You're going to hear from the CEO of the Registered Nurses Ontario Association, CEO Dr. Doris Grinspun. You're also going to hear from the OMA's president, Dr. Kassam, and then some more doctors on the ground and nurses who are concerned about the messaging and the impact of today's demonstrations.
And wow, Jackie, time flies. Election day is just 1 week away, and you'll be looking at how the federal leaders are polling.
Yeah, 1 week to go, Michelle. Hard to believe that. We're going to look at this final stretch, these Nanos numbers that came out last night. They're pretty interesting, in particular, the preferred prime minister category. We're going to get into that with our panel of experts and find out really what we should be watching for in these last 7 days.
Jackie and Reshmi, thank you so much. Have a great show. And CP24 tonight airs immediately following this newscast on CP24 from 7 to 9.
On the markets, the Canadian dollar was up 24 basis points to 79.02 U.S. American benchmark oil gained 73 cents a barrel to close at 70.45. And the TSX Composite Index gained 33 points to close at over 20,000.
Space history will be made later this week when a crew of four blasts into orbit.
What's so special about that? Well, there'll be no professional astronauts on board. This is the all-civilian crew that will roar off the pad at Cape Canaveral on Wednesday. The billionaire founder of an e-commerce firm is paying SpaceX for the three-day thrill ride. And he's taking along two sweepstakes winners and a healthcare worker who is a cancer survivor. The space tourists will splash down in the Atlantic after soaring to an altitude 160 kilometers higher than the space station. Good luck.
Down here on Earth, hot weather heading our way, but potentially unsettled, Michelle.
Absolutely. We're looking at a high of 27 degrees, feeling like 34 tomorrow, and there is a widespread risk of seeing some thunderstorms tomorrow, some severe in nature, so be aware of that. A little bit calmer later in the week and a little bit cooler as well. Back to you.
And be sure to join Zoraida Allman later tonight for CTV News at 11:30.
You can also stay up to date by going to our website. And a reminder, CP24 tonight begins momentarily on CP24.
I'm Michelle Jobin and all of us here at CTV News. Have a great night.